Welcome to Medicus, a student-run podcast about any and all things in the world of medicine. Follow along as we interview outstanding individuals about important topics in healthcare. Hello, welcome back to Medicus Podcast. I am Jackie, an M2 at Loyola Stritch, who is precariously close to Step 1 and Dedicated. Today, I have the honor of interviewing Ryan Ferrante, a collaborative reproductive attorney here in Chicago. Ryan received his JD from the John Marshall Law School in Chicago, his bachelor's degree from Ohio University, and he is a member of the American Bar Association, the Illinois State Bar Association, and the Chicago Bar Association. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being here today. So can you tell us what a collaborative reproductive attorney is?
Sure. First of all, I have to tell you, when I looked into the Medicus podcast, I saw a very diverse and broad cross-section of guests that you've had on, from supporting trans patients to body kindness to climate justice or injustice. And I thought, gosh, I hope I have something interesting to offer their guests. So thanks again for having me. I am, as you mentioned, a collaborative reproduction attorney or assisted reproductive technology attorney or any of the other number of names that you might hear that are used to describe the type of work that I do. I am a solo practitioner in Chicago, where I'm licensed to practice, but I didn't come to this practice of law by accident. I began my career as a boring old corporate tax attorney. Apologies to any tax attorneys that might be listening. I don't think you have any in your audience. It was while I began my career as an attorney then that my wife and I battled infertility for many years before we resolved that infertility with the help of a really wonderful surrogate, the best surrogate any intended parents could ever ask for, who's now forever part of our family. And so while my wife and Lindsay and I were overcoming those challenges of infertility, I pivoted in my career as a lawyer from tax to working with families like ours, whether it be in the form of egg donation or sperm donation, embryo donation, and most prominently, gestational surrogacy. So I am independent of any sort of matching agency or any other practice, and I work with intended parents, surrogates, and donors, really all parties to these collaborative reproduction arrangements like surrogacy. I suppose what you can say is that I provide counsel to anyone who wants to be a parent, but that process of becoming a parent requires some medical intervention, and specifically cases that involve a third party. So assisted reproduction that involves a surrogate or a donor, an intended parent or parents like my wife, Lindsay, and I. The term collaborative reproduction does not include the birth of a child conceived by means of sexual intercourse or the birth of a child conceived through assisted reproduction like just IVF or IUI, who are using their own gametes. But instead, it's an arrangement that involves the intended parents and that third party who, like a surrogate, who intend to gestate, and then the parents intend to become the legal parents of the child themselves.
Firstly, thank you so much for sharing your personal story about this. I know it can be an incredibly sensitive topic. Does every surrogacy arrangement require a lawyer?
Great question. The answer is yes. I'm going to say that at the outset with one important exception, but I would say, unless you are able to determine otherwise, the parties to a surrogacy arrangement, or I should say collaborative reproduction arrangements, do require independent legal representation, with an exception when it comes to gamete donation. And so every collaborative reproduction arrangement involves a discussion about not just the hopes and the desires and the intentions of the parties themselves, but also every agreement among many other things that are discussed includes a discussion with intended parents and surrogates about assumption of risk and acceptance of rights and relinquishment of rights, specifically the relinquishment of parental rights when it comes to a surrogate. On top of the inherent need for these parties to receive independent legal advice, the statute here in Illinois, the law that we rely on that governs these surrogacy arrangements, actually requires independent legal representation in order for it to be a valid arrangement. The Illinois Gestational Surrogacy Act states that a valid arrangement involves parties who have undergone legal consultation with independent legal counsel regarding the terms of the agreement and the potential legal consequences of gestational surrogacy. That's when it comes to gestational surrogacy. Yes, independent legal representation is always advised. On the gamete donation side, where we talk about egg donation or sperm donation or even an embryo donation, we really refer to the Illinois Parentage Act instead of the Illinois Gestational Surrogacy Act regarding the governance of those arrangements. So in donations, the Illinois Parentage Act tells us that any individual who is an intended parent, who intends to be the parent, is the legal parent of any resulting child. And if the donor and the intended parent have been represented by, here we go again, independent counsel, and entered into a written legal agreement in which the donor relinquishes or gives up all those rights and responsibilities to any resulting child, the intended parent is the parent of the child. And so those types of agreements have to be entered into prior to any sort of insemination or embryo transfer. So this is just me telling you that yes, in all of these collaborative reproduction arrangements, it is always advised to have independent legal representations, and sometimes there's a statutory requirement that the parties have legal representation. So these contracts between the parties in these collaborative reproduction arrangements, they not only define the terms and the rights and the obligations of the parties during the donations or surrogacy cycle, but also serves to resolve any disputes between the parties. But to your question, there may be a situation that does not require independent legal counsel. For example, in general, what about someone who makes a donation of gametes, say to a bank, like a sperm donor? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the Parentage Act actually addresses this scenario. And so what the Parentage Act tells us is that in these circumstances, if a person makes an anonymous gamete donation, egg or sperm, without a designated intended parent at the time of the donation, the intended parent, the eventual intended parent, is the parent of any resulting child, but only if that anonymous donor relinquished his or her parental rights in writing at the time of the donation. And so they have to submit a written relinquishment to the entity to which they are donating their gametes. So in those cases, you're not going to find independent legal representation because we don't know who the parties are yet, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these types of donations have this documented relinquishment with the entity to which the donation is made, not with the recipients or the intended parents. Very long answer, I know, to your very simple question.
No, it was very thorough. I appreciate it. It covered all my little questions about who needs a reproductive lawyer, who doesn't. But can you define something for me? I'm not a law person. What is independent legal representation? What does that mean specifically?
Great question. Independent legal representation means that the parties are receiving their own advice, meaning the intended parents, I'll use myself and my wife, Lindsay, as an example, had our own lawyer who drafted an agreement between us and our surrogate. Our surrogate had her own lawyer, separate from ours. So she is receiving legal advice independent of what we were receiving. Okay, that's very, very important because you could get into conflicts with the other party and whose interests is the lawyer really representing if they're just acting as a mediator between the parties. And so that's why there's this requirement for independent legal representation because of the importance of the profound impact of relinquishing parental rights.
I know some divorces and things like people can share a lawyer if it's really amicable, but this is not that kind of situation. You have independent.
Not a great idea.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
What are like common disputes or common issues that lawyers like yourself mitigate in these situations?
Sure. So it's probably easiest to sort of paint a picture of what the process looks like at a very high level. So we can talk about some general ideas about potential disputes, where they fit into the process, and how they're resolved. And so In any surrogacy arrangement, both parties have their own independent legal representation. And in almost all cases, the attorney who represents the intended parents will draft the agreement between the intended parents and the surrogate. Okay. And so when I am representing intended parents, one of the first steps is sort of gathering information. I'm having a very long conversation with my clients, and that very long conversation, it's metaphorically, that very long conversation starts once they have retained me. Okay. And so what we're doing is we're, again, gathering information to understand what their hopes and desires and intentions for the arrangement are. Okay. Now, sometimes the financial structure has already been set. The parties have discussed what the financial arrangements are, including health insurance, which is a whole nother podcast if you'd like to talk about that. But there is a, provisions in the agreement that are sometimes negotiated, such as a travel restriction, right? I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but we, in a surrogacy arrangement, we're really talking about two buckets. This is the way that I've always viewed it. The first bucket is the contract between the surrogate and the intended parents, which defines the terms and the rights and the obligations and the responsibilities of the parties. We eventually get to a final agreement. Those parties sign that agreement. And then in order for the surrogate to begin medications to prepare for an embryo transfer, her treating physician, her reproductive endocrinologist at the clinic must receive a letter of legal clearance from a lawyer. So one of the lawyers in the process will send a letter of legal clearance to the physician saying that, yes, the parties have signed an agreement in compliance with the terms of the laws of the state of Illinois. I give them very minimal information. They've agreed to up to 3 embryo transfers within 18 months, something like that. So once the letter has been received by the clinic, that's when lawyers sort of step back, let the physicians do their job, which is the most important part here. Surrogate achieves pregnancy. And then once she gets through that first trimester, that's when we turn our focus towards the second bucket, which is the establishment of legal parentage. Okay. Again, don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but I think it's important for your audience to understand this part. In any pregnancy, it's presumed that the woman who is carrying the child is the parent, right? Is the legal parent to the child. And the and if she's married, that presumption would extend to her spouse. So in a surrogacy, what we need to do is we need to rebut that presumption. We need to sort of present evidence that she is in fact not carrying her own child. Actually, the intended parents are the legal parents. So how do we do that? It depends. It depends on state law. Okay. And so the law of the state where the surrogate delivers is generally the jurisdiction where parentage is going to be established. Okay. And so what we have to do is look to that state's law to determine how do we rebut the presumption? How do we make sure that the intended parents are adjudicated the legal parents of the child, whether that be in the form of a court order or some other administrative process? So those are really the two buckets that we're trying to fill up, the contract and the legal parentage. And so back to your original question about disputes, where are the disputes between the parties? Well, good news, when it comes to this area of the law, it's generally uncontested, right? Everyone wants the same thing. Parents want to be the parents to the child carried by the surrogate. The surrogate does not want to be the legal parent to the child. And so the establishment of legal parentage in that second bucket is where we generally never see any sort of disputes other than, you know, if a surrogate has to sign paperwork, sometimes it's not received timely, right? Or if intended parents need to fill out paperwork, sometimes it's not received timely. The disputes really come in related to the terms of the agreement, okay? And these are usually all hashed out before the contract is even signed, okay? So the expectation is that there is not going to be a dispute because we've laid out what the terms of the arrangement are in the contract. I'll give you a couple of examples. The travel restriction. We want to make sure that she delivers in that state where we have taken steps or measures to establish legal parentage. We don't want her stepping into another state where no one knows that she's not carrying her own child. And so sometimes there's a negotiation over the that travel restriction? At which stage in the pregnancy is she no longer permitted under the terms of the agreement to leave the state, right? Because we want to do everything we can to make sure that she delivers in that state. I mentioned the financial terms. We talk about everything up to and including sharing of breast milk after delivery. We talk about the health insurance and what her conduct and her lifestyle is going to be like during a pregnancy or in preparation for that embryo transfer. I listen to the physicians tell, one of the general rules here is defer to the physician, listen to your doctor, whatever the doctor tells you to do in order to prepare for this embryo transfer, you're going to agree to do it. That's what the term that we put in the agreement. Then there are certain very specific terms about things to avoid during pregnancy. First of all, whatever the doctor tells you. And then, you know, sometimes we need to call out certain things like don't handle cat litter or no smoking, don't allow anyone to smoke in your home. Obviously, we need to make sure that those things are documented accurately in the agreement. Okay. And so a lot of times there's a negotiation on those. Now, one very important piece to that contract is also a discussion about a potential termination of pregnancy. Okay. Which has been, the Dobbs decision has added some confusion, how we discuss those matters in an arrangement. It's ultimately the surrogate's decision. It's always the surrogate's decision. That's why it's important for the parties to sort of be on the same page prior to an embryo transfer. So it's critical that the parties are having those types of discussions amongst themselves and with a licensed mental health professional prior to an embryo transfer to make sure that they know the areas where they could run into some disputes after signing the agreement. I hope that was also a clear but very long answer.
It was. You covered so many points in that. Just out of curiosity, the examples you kind of gave were a surrogate who is carrying the biological child of the intended parents. What happens if the surrogate's carrying like an embryo transfer from not the intended parents, or the surrogate is also the gamete donor? Does that complicate things?
So if the surrogate is providing material to the embryo that's going to be used, that is that's a separate legal matter. That's what is often referred to as traditional or genetic surrogacy. And so there is those types of arrangements do require different contract provisions in which they're relinquishing the rights, as long as there's an acknowledgement of the material that's being used to create the embryo. So those are separate legal matters, traditional or genetic surrogacy versus gestational surrogacy. That's a very, very good question. It doesn't come up very often. Now, if she is, if they are transferring a donor embryo, to the surrogate, you're going to have to look to state law to determine how do we establish legal parentage under those circumstances. I mentioned the Illinois Gestational Surrogacy Act. It's great law, but in terms of assisted reproduction or collaborative reproduction, it feels kind of old. Guess how old it is? It was written in 2005. Okay. So
a lot's changed.
A lot has changed since then. And the law is always the slowest to catch up to the technology, right? And so, the technology has advanced, but we're still working with this law from 2005. Now, because it was a law that was written in 2005, there's a couple of blind spots. Some people may say there's many more, and that's their opinion. I just think about a couple of blind spots in the law, as currently written. One of them is you can't use the statute if you're using an embryo in which there is no genetic connection to either intended parent. Okay. And so that when you're using a donor embryo, you cannot use the gestational surrogacy statute. So the establishment of legal parentage would happen in another form, in the form of likely an adoption. Okay. The other blind spot is there has to be a medical need for gestational surrogacy, which is not always the case with as to the reasons why couples or individuals may pursue gestational surrogacy. So a physician, the treating physician, the reproductive endocrinologist must sign an affidavit that gets attached to the contract that says the intended parents or intended parent has a medical need to pursue gestational surrogacy. They could not have a biological child in any other manner.
I'm assuming that also extends to like homosexual couples who wish to have a child.
For sure. A biological need. Yeah. It would qualify as a medical need. So that, you know, that happens all the time. I just sent two affidavits before we started recording where I asked a physician to sign the affidavit for a same-sex couple who is pursuing a gestational surrogacy arrangement.
Gotcha. Obviously, you have your own experience in this field, and that probably gave you a lot of insight into the medical background of this, but I feel like you know a lot about gestational medicine. Did you have to go to extra training for this, like aside from your law degree?
No, let me give you just a very brief, it's a great question. I really start every conversation that I have with someone who's experiencing infertility or somebody who's pursuing gestational surrogacy by telling them I was there. I understand. I know the rooms that you're in. I know the people that are sitting behind the desk and their mannerisms. I've been in that clinic. I know exactly what it's like. And so my wife and I went through 5 cycles of IVF ourselves in order to create the embryos that we needed to pursue gestational surrogacy with our wonderful surrogate, Stacy. As an attorney who was not practicing in this area back then, I sort of just threw myself into it, talking to lawyers and physicians whenever I had the opportunity, trying to understand what was the best path forward for us as patients. And then we became clients. I mean, my children were carried by a gestational surrogate in Florida, so we needed our own lawyer in the state of Florida. My children were both born in Tallahassee Memorial Hospital. Very fine medical services there for intended parents, by the way. And so when I was, you know, just practicing corporate tax law and experience infertility, I sort of threw myself into the law as well because I wanted to understand this very broad patchwork of laws that seems to exist when it comes to surrogacy in the United States. And so we can get into that discussion another time. But the laws regarding gestational surrogacy do vary from state to state. Once you cross a state line, things change pretty dramatically. Remember, 2 buckets. The first bucket is the contract between you and your surrogate. That's going to be governed by the laws of the state of Florida in our circumstance. So we needed a Florida lawyer to draft a contract that was compliant with the laws of the state of Florida. One of the requirements, I don't know if it's still the case, but one of the requirements at the time in the state of Florida, this is just to demonstrate how laws vary from state to state. This is not the case in Illinois. But in Florida, if a couple was pursuing gestational surrogacy, they had to be married.
Oh.
Okay. Which, you know, prior to marriage equality, complicated matters for same-sex couples in the state of Florida. Okay. So, yes, we did need our own attorney in the state of Florida for the first bucket, that contract, but then also to establish our legal parentage. Our attorney had to get a pre-birth order where a judge signs an order that says, you know, pending a final order or pending a notice of birth, Ryan and Lindsay Ferrante are the legal parents of the child being carried by gestational surrogate A. And so then, quite literally from the delivery room, I called our attorney who was in Fort Lauderdale and I said, Marla, guess what? Edward Ferrante was just born. And so she got a hearing that day, got the judge to sign the final order with our son's name on the order. That goes to vital records. Our names go on the birth certificate as the legal parents.
Okay. A lot of steps.
Yeah. A lot of things to consider.
Yeah. I just thought about something else too. You know, the terms and conditions of the document signed between the intended parents and the surrogate. Does that also include like postpartum health care?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. So I mentioned the health insurance. I'm only going to scratch the surface here. The general rule is that intended parents are responsible for all pregnancy-related medical expenses, okay? And then we layer on top of that whatever insurance the surrogate has, right? She must have insurance in order to engage in gestational surrogacy. Now, depending on who you ask, they may say the ratio is a little bit off, but for demonstrative purposes, I'll tell you that about 50% of the time, a surrogate's insurance will be surrogacy-friendly, meaning it will cover pregnancy-related expenses, whereas the other 50% of the time, or greater, there are situations in which the policy has a very specific exclusion. It may say something like this. The covered person, meaning the gestational surrogate, will not be covered for pregnancy-related expenses when acting as a gestational carrier. And so in those circumstances, depending on the timing, do we go to the ACA or do we have to go buy a Lloyd's of London policy? It really depends on the time of the year, but she's got to have health insurance that covers a surrogacy pregnancy.
The surrogate has to have health insurance.
Correct. Correct.
If they do not, could they just be completely covered by the intended parents?
No, because there wouldn't be a covered person under the policy. So in those circumstances, if the surrogate must purchase new insurance solely because she's going to be a gestational surrogate, that's going to be a cost that's borne by the intended parents. All of these medical expenses, this is what I was getting to from a mental health perspective, the intended parents are going to be responsible for all uncovered medical expenses related to the pregnancy, which would include mental health care. She's going to have a mental health assessment prior to the transfer occurring, prior to even being cleared to speak to a lawyer, frankly. But then there's always that contemplation of postpartum mental health counseling for the surrogate and who's going to be paying for that if it's uncovered.
This might be nitpickier, just thinking of the worst possible situations, but if there's a complication in the pregnancy and there has to be a medical decision made, how does that go about, you know, looking at the health of the surrogate, health of the fetus?
So this is something else that is contemplated. The general rule in the contract is that any decisions that are made regarding the surrogate's health alone are made by the gestational surrogate. Any questions regarding the child's health or the fetus's health are made by the intended parents. And if there's ever an imbalance and we need to say, well, it's affecting both, we look through it through the filter of how does this affect the surrogate first? If there is an emergency medical situation, we, you know, lawyers are hired to contemplate worst case scenarios, by the way. And so these are the types of things that we're thinking about. One of them being, what if there is a medical emergency with the pregnancy? Who's getting called first? Who's making the decision? Does it require a joint decision by the intended parents? And if they're not available, who are we going to call? Who's the emergency contact in those situations? And then on top of that, if none of them can be reached and time is of the essence and a decision must be made because there's an imminent threat to the health or life of the surrogate, then the surrogate gets to make those decisions if she's made reasonable attempts to contact those people.
Okay. Again, worst case scenario, but just interesting. You mentioned that there's affidavits that you send to like the endocrinologist and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Not talking about your experience as an intended parent in this situation, but you as a lawyer, do you work closely with any other medical professionals?
Let me answer it this way. I work with reproductive endocrinologists sort of indirectly through their staffs to ensure that all of the legal requirements have been met prior to the start of medications to prepare for the procedure, whether it's an egg retrieval for a donor or an embryo transfer for a surrogate. But then there's sometimes where, you know, I've had this happen quite regularly, more than I expected when I went into this area, where the physician will call me and say, hey, I have a question about the execution of this contract and some of the things that are being considered between the parties. It is still rare that something like that happens, but sometimes you have a very curious reproductive endocrinologist who wants to know more. Obviously, there's, you know, certain attorney-client privilege confines that I can't break, but you know, when they're talking about the application of the law or their signing of the affidavit under the laws of a particular state, what does it mean? I'm happy to answer those questions as well. So yes, my exposure to the reproductive endocrinologist as an attorney is pretty limited to that exchange of legal clearance to the clinic.
All right. Anyone else, though, like in delivery process or?
Oh, that's also a great question. Yes. In the state of Illinois, remember we talked earlier about rebutting the presumption, about presenting evidence. Well, in Illinois, we just have an administrative process. If we have a surrogacy arrangement that meets the requirements of the statute, there are several requirements in order to be able to cross this threshold. You don't need court intervention in some of those, in those cases, in order to establish legal parentage. So the administrative process here in Illinois is once we reach the second trimester, if I'm representing the intended parents, what we're going to do is we're going to send certification statements to all the parties. So the intended parents both get one, the surrogate, her spouse, if she has one, gets a certification statement, both attorneys sign a certification statement, and a qualified Illinois physician will sign a certification statement saying that the child being carried by the gestational surrogate is not hers. And so we have all these certification statements, the originals, the wet ink copies are going to go to the delivery hospital. That's what the law requires. And then copies of them go to the Illinois Department of Public Health, the Vital Records Department. And so when the child is born, those two entities, IDPH and the delivery hospital, will communicate with each other and confirm that the other has copies of the certification statements, and then the intended parent's names go on the birth certificate. So conversations with people at the delivery hospital is usually involving those certification statements and confirming receipt of those documents, or calling on behalf of my clients to talk about, you know, for example, can they get a room, their own room, while the surrogate is recovering after delivery? Is there a way for us to get an adjacent room? Because sometimes there's a breast milk sharing arrangement and it makes it a lot easier. So you shouldn't have to, right? As long as everything goes according to plan, there's not many situations in which lawyers are going to be constantly having communication with the delivery hospital, but sometimes it's required, yes.
From your own experience, having gone through infertility and gone through surrogacy twice, and obviously now as a practicing lawyer, what do you wish more medical professionals knew about this process, or what do you wish they had treated you like during it?
Lindsay and I had, we were patients at two separate clinics, and I learned very fast that personalities of physicians are vastly different. The first, where we didn't have much success, our physician had the best bedside manner of any physician I've ever met. He was very kind to my wife. He was gentle. I'm grateful to him because he's the one that encouraged us to get a second opinion. And so we were eventually treated at a clinic in Colorado where we had this wonderful physician who was all business, right? My jokes usually aren't funny, but he didn't laugh at them anyway. He was very focused on the science, and we were, the one thing that intended parents and surrogacy arrangements or infertility patients don't have is patience, right? They've run out of it. And so we were also very focused on the science as well. And so we did have success there. It's just a different experience because of the personalities of the physicians. From a patient perspective, that's what I usually tell others who are exploring this. Don't expect reproductive endocrinologist A to be the same as B. Okay. But if for the physicians themselves, and I know that they know this, but it's always worth reinforcing that the laws that govern these arrangements vary from state to state, right? And so I've already made a couple of distinctions about the laws of the state of Illinois. They are different than, say, the laws of Indiana or the laws of the state of Michigan. For example, believe it or not, it is it's a crime to help or aid in or assist in a surrogacy involving compensation in the state of Michigan. They're trying to change that, but it's still a crime. There are no compensated surrogacy arrangements in Michigan that have valid contracts. Let's put it that way.
It's a pro bono surrogacy situation in Michigan, I guess.
Well, yeah, compassionate surrogacy is the way we call it.
What is the definition of compensation in this? Does that include like medical coverage?
Anything above a reimbursement. Anything above, covering medical costs or travel expenses. We're talking about compensation for her time and for her service of carrying the child.
What is the range of that outside of Michigan, obviously? What is the compensation range?
The range is so wide, I even hesitate to give you numbers. I mean, I'll just tell you from my experience in compensated surrogacy arrangements, I've had arrangements as low as, say, $10,000 for a surrogate to receive compensation for the entire pregnancy. And she earns that in phases, by the way. So she would, earn 1/10 of it once a month, and then the balance would be due once the live birth has occurred, or once she reaches a certain milestone in the pregnancy, such as 32 weeks, she earns full compensation. So as low as 10, I've seen, as high as 75, 80,000 sometimes. It just depends on the agency they're working with, the promises that the parties have made to each other, discussions that they've had before they talk to a lawyer. Unfortunately, sometimes those types of terms are agreed to prior to talking to a lawyer, and expectations have been already set.
Is there an ethical reason why compensated surrogacy would be frowned upon?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. It's just one of those things that's been on the books for so long. you know, a lot of states reacted to a case, you know, the sort of the landmark surrogacy case in which a woman refused to give up the child. And so state legislatures reacted decades ago to compensated surrogacy and said, we're not going to allow that here, right? And so there's historical factors, there's political factors, there's, you know, special interests who are trying to keep gestational surrogacy from becoming safe and legal in a particular state. But there's no one answer to that question.
Fair. I was just curious. So you've based your entire career off of helping people struggling with infertility, and that's incredibly admirable. But you actually have taken it a step further by being the chair of National Infertility Association, Resolve. Can you tell me and the audience more about that?
Of course. I appreciate that title, but it's not entirely accurate. I'm the co-chair of Federal Advocacy Day for Resolve. And co-chair because I have an incredible partner. Her name's Lisa Rosenthal. She's a patient advocate from Connecticut, who I definitely could not do this without. And so we are the co-chairs of the volunteer committee who helps Resolve, the National Infertility Association, plan for and carry out their important and very necessary Federal Advocacy Day. First of all, Resolve, I don't know if all of your audience is going to know who Resolve is. So let me just give you just a brief background. Resolve is a nonprofit organization whose focus is on promoting reproductive health, and they work tirelessly to ensure equal access to all family building options, some of which we discussed today, for men and women who are experiencing infertility or other reproductive barriers. Resolve is very good at many, many things. One of them is reminding anyone who listens that infertility is a disease, and it affects one in every eight couples. That is an enormous number of people to represent for a small nonprofit like Resolve, particularly when they only have 12 full-time staff. Okay? 12 full-time staff. So they rely on the commitment of volunteers to sort of implement their really ambitious ideas to advocate on behalf of the population of people who are experiencing those barriers to infertility. As co-chairs of Federal Advocacy Day, Resolve partners with the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. Mm-hmm. And so the power of those two organizations together is used to empower the community of infertility patients, advocates, people who are affected by infertility, people whose families are affected by infertility. We all come together and we have conversation with members of Congress about the need for increased access to family building options. And that really means an increased access to care. And so this is a one-day virtual event. This year it is April 25th. Every advocate or people who are there just to support the advocates are all part of a larger state delegation. So here in Illinois, we meet with Senator Durbin or Senator Duckworth or their staffs or Congressman Quigley, if you live in Chicago or other parts of Chicago, you meet with the your local representative. But you may also go to meetings in which you are not a constituent because somebody may be joining you in your meeting with the United States representative. And so there's an experienced advocate in every meeting. They're all virtual. In the past, we had done this in person, but that was pre-COVID. And so we've sort of transitioned into this virtual environment. The real mission of Advocacy Day is to share stories about how infertility affects so many of us and how the United States Congress can help so many of their constituents. The number one barrier, this is important, the number one barrier to treatment is the cost and access to health insurance that covers infertility medical treatment, specifically IVF, is inadequate. And so that's our purpose. My wife and I, for example, were incredibly lucky. Both of us at the time, we were working for employers who provided benefits for that covered the cost of some of the IVF. We obviously exhausted all of that coverage and then exhausted all of our resources to have the family that we wanted. And so these benefits ran out, but they were an enormous help to us because there are some people who maybe get to that point, don't have any coverage at all, and stop. That's the story that I tell lawmakers when I meet with them. Why were we afforded this opportunity that because of the work that we did or the state that we lived in, that we had this coverage? That just doesn't make sense. Advocates don't need a story to tell if they're not comfortable doing so. Some people are there just to support advocates who are sharing their story about how they can't afford to have the family that they want. Just by being present, advocates who show up on Advocacy Day are saying, this is unacceptable. We as a country should be doing better. We have to do more to help those who suffer from infertility. And I've seen it in those meetings. I've met with members of Congress who are not the most likely to be a welcoming audience, but they have reacted in a meeting in a way that was profound. And they've said, I see that this is important to my constituents. And so it's raising that awareness. And by the way, we're doing this during National Infertility Awareness Week. It's the Tuesday of National Infertility Awareness Week. By the way, very quickly, Resolve does all the heavy lifting here. They set up the meetings. They give you ideas about how to craft your elevator pitch, right, to talk to a member of Congress. For me, it's always been about simplifying the approach to say, go into these meetings and answer two questions. Number one, tell them why you're there. Number two, tell them how they can help you. And so what we're really asking is for the support on these issues in the form of co-sponsorships of certain bills. We emphasize to them in these meetings that these are pro-family issues, right? That's a very important message to send to them. These are about people who want to build their families. These are pro-family issues. So on top of expanding access to treatment, another really big issue that we talk about in these meetings, whether it's in the form of, you know, literature that we leave behind, or maybe we have a patient who is discussing this very issue, but we do ask for support on issues regarding fertility preservation as well. Far too often, thousands are diagnosed with cancer, and that treatment jeopardizes their ability or future ability to have a family. And so as an organization, we're trying to drive home to lawmakers that no one should have to choose between the medical treatment of their conditions and the chance to be a parent. And so we should be expanding coverage to preserve fertility as well. Just as a general matter, it's also very important to secure permanent coverage of IVF for wounded veterans who have sacrificed so much already, right? That should not extend to the chance at having their own families. There's a lot of these bills that are just waiting to be acted on. And so we go into these meetings and say, Senator A and House Member B have already introduced bills on the House and Senate side. We could really use your support on these issues. You've heard these stories. That's why.
So how can a listener right now, what can they do? Can they go on Resolve website? How can they support?
Best question of the day. Go to resolve.org. On the website, you can find a lot of information about how you can support local initiatives to expand coverage in your state. On resolve.org, people can sign up for Advocacy Day. It's free. It's April 25th. Again, all of the heavy lifting is done by Resolve. They will tell you what meetings you're going to, who you're going to the meetings with. You'll meet with your state delegation. It's a really great way to meet people. There are physicians, there are lawyers, there are patients. You do not need to speak in these meetings. Okay. I always encourage people that if you're ever interested in advocacy, sign up for Resolve's Federal Advocacy Day. I can promise you, you're going to see a lot about how advocacy works, but also you can use the first year as a way to observe, right, about how these meetings work and how you meet with the staff or the member of Congress and ask them for their support. On resolve.org, there is a link to Advocacy Day. You can sign up and you will be contacted right away.
Thank you so much, Ryan, for doing this with me. I really appreciate it.
It was absolutely my pleasure. I, of course, want to just make one other offer to anyone in your audience. If there's anyone who ever has, you know, questions about infertility or dealing with infertility or legal questions about surrogacy or gamete donation, I probably spend more time talking to non-clients about all those matters than I do my own clients. So please take me up on that.
Of course, we will have Resolve's website and your contact information on the episode description.
Thanks for listening to this episode. This wouldn't be possible without the support from our listeners. Please rate, review, and subscribe. We appreciate donations to help fund the production of this podcast. To support us, go to medicuspodcast.com, where you can additionally find show notes, links, and information about our guests. We are at Medicus Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. If you have any questions, comments, or episode suggestions, please submit them on our website. This podcast is intended for general information purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine. No patient-doctor relation is formed, and the content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Views and opinions are their own and do not represent any organization.